previously.tvpodcastnetwork.
I'm trying to prevent your movie from being a flop. I am not some evil genius who was greedy and wanted some guy to rob a bank for me. I didn't have anything to do with the goddamn crime.
The lengths people will go to rob banks is positively eerie. Sorry, not sorry. Toby Ball is back to look at two notorious money-for-nothing cases, Western PA's pizza delivery heist and Netflix's Evil Genius, and Seattle's Hollywood string of bank robberies in FBI files. In the Blotter Presents, episode 54... Hello, everybody. Welcome back to The Blotter Presents. Thank you for your patience while we took a week off, while the production team was moving back to the 48 contiguous, but now we are all back. And so is Toby Ball to talk about Evil Genius and the FBI files on The Blotter Presents. Welcome back, Toby.
Hi, Sarah.
For you being on The Blotter, it's actually been a shockingly long time. What has it been, a whole month?
It's been something like that. I've missed it.
Yeah. You're very sweet to say that. I feel like I just talked to you because I just did talk to you. When can listeners hear my special Patreon-only Crime Writers on Book Club episode?
It's up right now. It is on the Partners in Crime Media Patreon site for people who are $5 or more a month. Patrons.
I think the discussion in general is definitely worth the money. My contributions, perhaps not, but it was a delight to do. And thank you for having me.
Oh, it was a lot of fun.
All right. So today we are going to talk about Evil Genius, which is the latest Duplass Brothers Netflix crime docuseries that will be dropping this Friday, the 11th. Here is the case file. Per Netflix's PR write-up, in 2003 in Erie, Pennsylvania, a robbery gone wrong and a terrifying public murder capture the nation's attention, and a bizarre collection of Midwestern hoarders, outcasts, and lawbreakers play cat and mouse with the FBI. Eventually, a middle-aged mastermind named Marjorie Deal Armstrong, once a town beauty, now a woman grappling with mental illness, is arrested. But 15 years later, Evil Genius proves there's more to the conspiracy and murders than was ever thought. And how? This is a 4-episode series. We got the first 2 screeners. I was very sad that I couldn't keep watching. Toby, did you watch both screeners? And did you also want to keep going when you were done?
Yes and yes. It's really interesting.
It's a lot. It starts out with this guy, Brian, with what looks like a bomb padlocked around his neck with a giant neck handcuff. The bomb is under a shirt and he has a gun. He has a cane gun that he's sort of swinging jauntily, goes into a bank, tries to rob it, does not get away with much money, and is apprehended while he's trying to leave. There's pages and pages and pages of scavenger hunt / ransom instructions. It's not clear whether he's a part of this or was really grabbed up by the masterminds in order to rob this bank. As they all do, he blames it on a couple of black dudes in clip 2.
Co-workers at Mamma Mia's pizzeria saw Wells leave to deliver 2 sausage and pepperoni pies to a remote location, an unoccupied radio tower.
He was saying it was black people jumped him and put the collar around his neck.
We should call the key out and start at a time.
He never said who it was. He couldn't describe the black individuals that he claimed. put the bomb around his neck. You know in your heart that there's probably not a black person involved in it, but that's what they're going to say.
I literally, my notes were like, of course that's what he's going to say. It was black people. Spoiler, it's fucking never black people. So he claims that he went out on a pizza run and was like caught up in this thing, and they strapped the bomb to him and sent him on this like literal wild goose chase. He's apprehended before he could get to any of the next stops that will allow him to unlock slash defuse this bomb. There's like this standoff in the parking lot where he's like in handcuffs, actual handcuffs, sitting next to a police cruiser, like protesting that he has nothing to do with it and he's innocent. And then the bomb starts peeping. And at this point in the narrative, I was like, you know, wow, this is really like a elaborate punking and really, really shitty to do to this guy. And then the bomb detonates, like it's strapped to his neck, and they don't show the entire explosion, but they showed enough that I was actually shocked.
Yeah. They show like 8 frames or something.
Yeah.
Like enough to like give you the picture.
Yeah. There's like aerosolized blood. Yeah. And they show a number of pictures of like the aftermath, which are not, it's not gory. It's just like, you know, what a way for this guy to go.
Right.
And I was startled by it, which I guess is the point, but I was a little surprised that they went ahead and showed that.
It's definitely much more than you're used to. I mean, it's a little bit like when you first see the Zapruder film.
Yes.
Of Kennedy,
yes.
Where it's just so much more graphic than what you're used to seeing. So I think it's shocking because you're not used to seeing it. I don't know if there's, I'm not really sure why they did it. Because it's not, to me, it didn't seem like it added anything. Like what they talk about later makes it seem much more, sort of visceral than that, those few frames that you do see. But the whole thing was very odd in that the guy with the bomb strapped to him, you know, until the very end, doesn't seem to be taking it too seriously. In that he, when he's in the bank, he's, you know, sort of twirling his little gun cane, and
yeah, he's quite jaunty. We do have a clip. Yeah. We do have a clip about that. So let's have a listen, and then I wanted to discuss how much we thought he knew or really was capable of knowing. So let's hear clip 3.
Actually reached into the basket to pull out a lollipop. Why would you feel comfortable enough and take a lollipop? And why would you, as the witness described, walk out of the bank like Charlie Chaplin, swinging the bag and the cane gun? Why or how could an individual who knew they had a live device around their neck be so calm?
This is one of the FBI lead agents on the case who looks enough like Armand Asante, in my opinion, that it's a little disconcerting for that accent to be coming out of him. Side issue.
Yes.
I paused the screener at this point because I like the narration and the talking head interviews kind of dance around the issue of whether he had a developmental delay, this guy.
But I can't
decide whether the movie wants us to mull over, like, he knew it wasn't going to go off because he was complicit, and so he was pretty cash about it. He didn't think it was going to go off because that's what he was told. He thought it was all a big joke. He didn't think it was live. He had built it. Like, I'm just not sure what the series wants us to think about what he thought.
See, yeah. My read on that, you know, just having watched the first two, was that he, I mean, this is just a theory, but that, the two, what are their names? The geniuses.
Marjorie Diehl Armstrong is the lady genius. And then, God, why can't I remember? Richard, I want to say.
Ross is somebody Rothstein.
Right. I want to say Arnold Rothstein, but very, very different set of crimes. Keep talking, yeah. And I'm just going to
okay. So my sense is that these two, like, quote-unquote geniuses who are so clear that they're smarter than everybody else had found this guy who, you know, if he wasn't developmentally delayed, like almost everybody says that he was, you know, a little bit childlike and naive and, you know, he's a pizza delivery guy. And that they found him, you know, to be useful, and that they probably told him that this they had this foolproof, you know, bank heist idea. We'll pretend we put this bomb on you. Nobody's going to want to get near you. You take off. You meet us here, and you know we'll take off the fake bomb. And ha ha ha! And we'll have money to spread around. And then, of course, because they're evil geniuses, not just geniuses, they actually do put a live bomb on it. And you know, they later. The cops determined that there's no way that he could have gone around and done the scavenger hunt to get all the keys and knowledge he needed to get the thing off.
I think they drove the exact route. Bill Rothstein.
Bill Rothstein.
Yeah. I mean, they drove the exact route under the exact conditions and like same weather, same time of day for traffic, just to assure themselves that you know, to see whether it could or could not be done. And it turned out it could not be done. But yeah, like they furnished Brian Wells with so many instructions and to this ridiculously detailed degree. And you'll be able to see some of those on our social media. That's Blotter Presents on both Facebook and Twitter. I posted one today on Twitter that he was supposed to leave the bank and go to a nearby McDonald's and like the like heater piece in the parking lot where the sign is, that he's supposed to like look under a rock, and then the instructions draw that it's like, here's the McDonald's sign and here's a plant and here's the rock and the like an arrow and the word rock. Like, okay, how
it's what you do for a 6-year old, like at a birthday party.
Yeah. And
here's the house. Here's the rock. Look underneath the rock.
Yeah. And then there's going to be a rhyme of some kind. Like, I just, and I'm not sure whether that speaks more to Brian Wells's intellectual capabilities or that one or both of the evil genii in question here was decompensating and not able to like focus on the task at hand. But yeah, the FBI and the state investigators who take apart the bomb actually have a pretty interesting profile of who's responsible based on how the bomb was built, in clip 4. This is kind of a long one, but I think it's germane.
The neck cuff would have operated just like a standard handcuff in that when closed, it would ratchet and lock. The case and the collar itself would have taken somebody some time. We're talking probably on the order of a month in their spare time to assemble this.
The first timer attached to the first bomb was probably activated by the release of a cotter pin. And there was a second cotter pin on the device. If that cotter pin would have been pulled, would have given Mr. Wells another hour.
An extension is put on the handle, and it merely swings around and closes the contact when it gets down to zero.
The one thing that sticks out about the device was all of the red herrings that were incorporated into the device. That was, in my opinion, I believe in the investigative team's opinion, designed to prevent the bomb squad from tampering with it. Yeah, there were wires that didn't mean anything. There was a plastic cell phone incorporated that didn't mean anything. The device was fairly sophisticated, although at the end of the day, it was just two pipe bombs and two timers.
This put me in mind of both the Zodiac and Leopold and Loeb in the sense that there is this just gelid approach to their crimes that is like, this is, it's like a game build. and not people's lives.
Yeah. And I think, you know, when you do, when they do start focusing on the two quote unquote geniuses, the, like, if I was like a cop, I mean, that would be what I would see, I think, is that these people are, you know, they're narcissists, they're detached, and that it's not hard from what you see of them and what you hear of them, for the most part, to picture them, especially with people who they, you know, if he's people they think aren't smart or slow or whatever, that they would feel like their lives were to play with potentially.
Sure.
So yeah, I thought, and it is kind of an interesting, again, it's like kind of playing head games with the people who are going to be defusing the bomb, potentially, which they didn't, of course, but it's, you know, the whole, which wire do you clip? And then when you put in a whole bunch of fake wires to confuse the situation, so,
and then there's a whole bunch of written instructions on the physical housing of the bomb that reminded me of, like, when you are, you know, when you blow a fuse and you're like downstairs, like, well, you know, which to, like, you're turning on and off every single one to figure out, like, where's the fucking front hall?
That's exactly what I was thinking.
Yeah.
Yeah. Or then you have the, you have them all written, but they don't, like, quite match up with what the, which ones are the fuse, the breakers. So you're like, okay, which lines up? And
yeah, or your electrician wrote it in felt tip and is left-handed. True story.
Yeah, exactly.
Like, dude, right. You have to go.
Or things have been changed. They like reference something that's not in the house anymore, so you just have no idea.
Yeah.
Like, anyway,
the horse lamp. Like, that's, is that a thing?
Exactly. Exactly. But like those writings are like completely, you know, in keeping with the, you know, six or nine page or whatever it was, instructions for him about how to go on this crazy treasure hunt to find out how to save his life.
And yet, the ones that can't wait to show you how smart they are the sometimes the easiest ones to catch, maybe not prosecute, but catch, because at some point someone points out, like, okay, this, like, Erie is right on, I guess, Interstate 90. So you can be in one of two other states in like 10 minutes. And so what you do if you rob a bank is rob it, get the fuck out, like get a car and leave the state. But this scavenger hunt sent, or was supposed to send, I guess, or maybe it wasn't, was supposed to send Brian Wells like in a big loop just around the area and kind of back to the part of town where he had initially been sent on the pizza delivery call. So like they outsmarted themselves. And then when Rothstein does show up, in reference to a completely other murder where, like, apparently the body is being hoarded in his meat freezer and he has called the cops, he can't wait to give them a tour and tell them, like, how the body was put in the freezer and, like, on and on. Like, he can't wait to get credit for being a genius. And it's like, dude, like, you're on video, like, giving a tour of your hoard to law enforcement. Right. What are you doing?
Yeah, plus it's just like, you know, he's admitting to being an accessory after the fact, just right off the top. You know, it's like, yeah, well, she, you know, she called me up and I went over and his dead body was at a 45-degree angle on the bed, and she wanted me to do something with it. And, you know, I didn't want to do anything right away, so I thought I'd put it in the freezer. It's like, what are you talking about? You know, that's not a typical reaction to one of your friends calling you up and saying they killed somebody and they're on a mattress. It's like, well, I'll wrap them up in a tarp and I'll put them in my deep freezer.
Yeah.
And then we'll figure out what to do.
Except that we're sort of introduced to this entire narrative with, And this was a little confusing to me because there's a narrator who is being yelled at by Marjorie Deal Armstrong at the top of the episode. We heard that clip.
Yeah.
I wrote his name down somewhere. He's a co-director. Barbara Schroeder is the writer and director. And then this guy, I guess, like, just got sucked into the strangeness of this.
Well, he wrote her a letter, right? That's what happens like right at the end of the second episode, as he says, I wrote her a letter, and then she wrote me right back. And then I began that correspondence. And at some point, he has like a box like full of letters, right? Where he's just like, this is just some of them.
Yeah, I think so. I'm going through my notes trying to find this guy's name. Bonzilieri? Trey?
That sounds right.
Bonzilieri. It's they don't do a great job, in my opinion, of like I understand that she's a sort of interesting, charismatic figure, but I'm not sure they do a great job. Sort of like they introduce her, and then you know eventually she has to tie back in to this case, and it's not that they don't create effective suspense, but I have learned, having done this job for a while, that if, you know, no good can come of Googling, but when you get bored, because then you're really going to be bored.
Right.
So I definitely tried to resist looking up like what might have happened. And, you know, some of it is inevitable, but I think that they maybe should have brought her back in a little sooner. At times it felt like they were stalling, sort of not really telling us like what her diagnoses were, what exactly happened to her past boyfriends. Like, I just kind of felt like, all right, either she's in the foreground or she's not. Someone has to draw some conclusions, or we're going to just go to the internet and do it ourselves.
So they did an interesting thing, I think, in that through two episodes, you basically have two crimes, and they may or may not. I mean, they're probably related, or else you wouldn't be doing it this way. But
right, exactly.
it's not completely apparent to the investigators at the point that we're at, like how they are, other than proximity. But what they do is they introduce Marjorie briefly. Then they have the story of the bank robbery, in which she has no connection at all so far that we know of. And then – so you go through that entire – so you're introduced to her. Then you go through an entire episode about a crime that has no – that she has no part of that you can see.
Right. But you're sort of waiting. Yeah.
Right. But then it never happens in that episode. Then you go to the next episode, and then there's a crime in which she's completely implicated. And then they're talking about how, like why they think that those two are connected. And in some ways, it seems like the logical way would have been to do it the other direction, which is, you know, they find the body in the freezer. Oh, that's weird. You know what else is weird? And then go into the whole thing with the bank robbery, because that was the process that they were using when they were that was the process that the police used, is that, oh, there's a body in a freezer 100 yards from where the pizza guy got the thing on his neck. And so in some ways, that would have made a little more sense to me, even though chronologically it's reversed. But then at least you're following – like you understand like where Marjorie fits into the whole bank robbery thing, that it's not just – because otherwise you're just guessing, you know, or you're not even guessing.
You are just waiting for her to like be tagged back in by something else happening. And in this case, it's that Rothstein leaves the narrative sooner than you think he's going to. I'll leave it at that. Definitely makes a point, not that anyone asked him this, of being like, this has nothing to do with that bank thing. And everyone's like, well, it didn't before, but now it definitely does. And also, you know, you live, you and your, you know, pile of hoarded Tupperware containers live within sight of where the pizza call was. So, and there's not that much else around there. So now we're really looking at you. But I'm torn. Like, it's not that it's not an effective setup, like narrative structurally, because it is, like, to open with her and then just to leave us waiting for when she's going to come back in. It is effective. It's just risky. Because a lot of people just be like, well, I'm just going to see how this all fits together and just Google it. And I was like, I could do that, but I'm not going to, you know, I'm going to be less of an Aries for once and just like let them tell the story. And overall, it's quite well told, but I don't know, like part of me feels like it should have been like even longer so that they could give us more background on her when we finally do get into it with her and her,
right,
whatever her like emotional problems or undiagnosable challenges are. But this was someone who like definitely is known to local media because instead of just breaking up with people, well, clip five.
We had covered her before. There was a murder trial years before when she had shot and killed her boyfriend. Thomas was sleeping on a couch, and she unloaded a gun into him.
She laughed about it. She thought it was funny. She says, I shot that motherfucker six times. She says, I got away with it. I said, well, how'd you do that? She said, self-defense. She said, I told him he was beating me up. But she actually did it and got away with it and knows she got away with it.
Her attorneys were able to convince the jury that she felt that her life was in danger because of the culture in which she was living. So that was obviously a sensational case. And so Marjorie had been on the radar with us for quite some time.
Now, is it me or do they imply that like three or four of her other boyfriends just like disappeared or like fell and died, but probably didn't fall? That wasn't just me, right?
No, they do. She just shot that one guy to death. And then the only one she was actually married to died when he fell and hit his head on a coffee table. And then she sued the hospital for like $170,000 or something. She seems very litigious, by the way.
Yeah.
And
she does.
But they do also mention that I think they say like four or five. And they haven't gotten to those, and I assume they'll probably get to them at some point. But it is kind of, they're dishing out the information along the way.
I guess it is working because I am finding it like frustrating enough. Like, you know, we have to wait for the other episodes, so. I guess it's sort of a testament to how well these were done that I'm like, well, why weren't we told more about this? And why aren't we going to hear about that? Like, I don't know how everything ties together. I do know certain facts about the case that I, you know, I tried to avert my eyes, but Wikipedia screwed me.
I never look up any of this stuff. Unless I know I'm not going to watch the rest of it.
Yeah.
And I'm definitely going to watch the rest of this. I mean, I think it seems like the Duplass brothers have a pretty good eye for what's going to be a good story. Because Wild Country. Did you do something about that, right?
We did. Just in our previous episode, we were like the last crime podcast to talk about it, but we got around to it.
I mean, it wasn't a perfect documentary, but man, what a story.
And it was definitely worth watching. But that one had a similar issue. I was talking about it with my guest, Kevin Smokler, and we were just like, there were certain things that like, that it seemed like they would mention it and it's like, well, surely we're going to return to,
right,
to that part of it. And then they don't. And then there were certain things that were never made explicit that it was like, well, surely we're going to hear about what a, you know, grave danger to children this cult was. And, you know, it wasn't being sex positive when there are basically no I mean, I guess there were some minors in the compound. Doesn't matter. There were no complaints about that part of it. And this one is, I think, maybe that's why I'm like a little concerned that they're going past things and that they're not going to come back to them. And maybe they are. Maybe I'm wrong.
Yeah, I kind of see them like, I don't know whether it's them or whether the directors or whatever, but in especially in Wild Wild Country, which I've seen all of, so I know what they had and didn't have, like having a conversation about what's the story, you know, what's the story that we're going to tell, because there must have been so much stuff about the Rajneeshis. Because just like just reading the couple of New Yorker articles about them, like I like read about a lot of stuff they didn't have in there. So it's so they're trying to figure out what story is it that we're trying to tell. And it becomes, you know, kind of a it's not exactly freedom of religion, but, you know, an odd religious group in the state. And, you know, and then this, you know, the whole Sheila going off the rails and the Bhagwan always being off the rails.
And yeah, just like power corrupts. I mean, you have a bunch of different stories, and sometimes the story you think you have, like, it looks like something different when you're putting it together.
Because I felt like I wanted to see what, like, in that, and I don't want to derail this conversation, but it just, you know, there was all these people who were at Rajneeshpuram who, you know, weren't involved in, you know, poisoning food or, you know, giving drugs to homeless people or all these like totally messed up things. They're just basically there because, you know, they dug the scene.
And they continued to be there. This wasn't like a handful of
hippie nuts.
This was like thousands of people. Anyway, yeah.
And a lot of them were like professionals and stuff. But I just it was strange that that was not addressed at all. It was like, why would people be here? Like, what's the attraction? It just seems like this, like, completely psychotic situation. Anyway,
yes.
back to the one we're talking about.
But it's a testament to that, that, like, as imperfect as it was and as frustrating as a lot of us felt, or frustrated as a lot of us felt about what wasn't in there and other things we wanted to learn about it, we're still talking about it.
Oh, yeah. And I recommended it to tons of people.
Oh yeah, no.
I was just like, you gotta check this out. It's just like batshit insane.
It's super watchable. And while I'm on the subject, I would also like to circle back to the director Barbara Schroeder, the other feature documentary that she was at the helm of was called Tall Hot Blonde.
Oh, you know, I've never seen that, although it always pops up in my feed.
It's like Catfish the movie, except way better. Sorry, Catfish the movie. I actually enjoyed you and the show, but yeah, it's good. It's good, and it's direct. Like, there's not a lot of sometimes with these, like, you know, the internet is coming to corrupt and kill us all.
Yeah.
Documentaries, the pearl clutching can be a little much, but I remember liking Tall Hot Blonde a lot.
Huh. All right, I'll check it out.
But yeah, these guys definitely have a good ear for what's gonna work in this medium, which is like relatively new. In our last clip, I mentioned before the like references that I was drawing to other sort of notorious crimes or the notorious coverage of these crimes. See if you can figure out which one this might have reminded me of.
You murder two people and that's it? For certain, you murdered two people. And you go sit in some mental institution where the food's better, another quote of hers. I just find that ridiculous.
All right. This is a former cellmate of Marjorie Deal Armstrong's. And I really feel like someone needs to just write like a play about like Waiting for Godot, but with the two of them. But did that, there was something about her talking about Marjorie in that way that put me in mind of the Jinx, and not even the Jinx, but just like Robert Durst. and his thinking he's smarter than everybody else, thinking that he can buy his way out of trouble, having these like Rube Goldbergian plans to get rid of bodies. Like, it just reminded me of him somehow.
Yeah.
Did you get that at all or no?
Yeah. I mean, I feel like all these narcissists.
Well, like, yeah.
Like there is this sort of, sense that they're just operating on a different plane and that they really can't be touched by normal people. I mean, John McLaughlin. Did you listen to S-Town?
Yes, I did.
Yeah. I mean, he wasn't a criminal, at least in that way. So I don't mean to lump him in with killers, but he was another guy who kind of sort of felt like he operated on a different plane than the people around him.
Yeah. Big fish in small pond itis.
Yeah, exactly.
Perhaps.
And in, you know, and I just kind of believe that if he went to New York City, it would just be a big fish in a bigger pond, you know, in his own mind. That's interesting. And I think didn't Dersch, he got arrested because he was shoplifting a sandwich in a Wegmans. Yeah. If I remember that correctly.
Yeah.
Jesus.
I know. Yeah. I think that's in, pretrial motions are wrapping up.
Oh, really?
With that one. I'll try to, someone on our, someone tweet at me to remind me to look that up. I think I've been posting some updates on our Twitter feed. Once again, that's at Blotter Presents. So you're going to keep watching this when it drops Friday.
Oh yeah, absolutely. I think it's really good.
Yeah, me too. And Wild Wild Country, like that one, like carried me right along. I was like, how many episodes? Dang, like I have to watch all of these, but then it was a pleasure. This yes. is only four as far as I know. And once again, that's on Netflix on the 11th. Let's hope we have.
Are they dropping them all?
I think so.
Yeah. All right. Yeah. Cool.
No. Yeah. I think trying to act like it's a weekly show is a Hulu thing. And I kind of wish Hulu would quit it with that. Like, just give me the whole Handmaid's Tale at once.
Yes.
Although not that.
I haven't even started that yet, which I think. Like, I think I'm saving them up so I can binge them.
Yeah, I think I might do that too. All right, speaking of Hollywood product, that's probably a really bad play on words, but in our cold case section, we are talking about the FBI Files, Season 3, Episode 4, Terror in Disguise. That's really not a great title, and it's actually not a great episode. We'll get into it, but first, the case file. The tech industry brought unprecedented growth to the Seattle area in the early to mid-1990s, and the bank robber known to law enforcement as Hollywood had apparently decided to cash in. Hollywood was prolific, committing 18 bank heists and making off with nearly $2.3 million total, but was he just predictable enough to get himself caught by the FBI? Spoiler, not exactly. Let me just double back to Evil Genius, because I forgot to ask if you had heard anything about this case, about that case before, because that one was all new to me.
I don't think so. For some reason, when I heard about the handcuff on the neck or whatever, that kind of it seemed familiar, but I knew none of the details. So I must have just like read it in passing or something.
Yeah,
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
I didn't remember anything about it, and someone would have called it out to me because I used to be a pizza delivery girl. Fortunately, no one ever sent me into a bank to take their money with a bomb around my neck. Sorry, what were you going to say?
Oh, I just we never even talked about like they had to decapitate his corpse to get that thing off.
Yeah.
That was such a, you know.
And then there was a whole like sequence where his family was like reading this statement about how, you know, thoughtless and cruel that was to him and his memory. And the medical examiner's like, look, it's not like we enjoyed doing that. It was harsh.
But at the same time, can you just take a torch to the thing and just like, you know, cut it open in one spot and just crank it open?
If I'm not mistaken, I think the issue was that they were afraid that by like interfering with the mechanism itself, I think they weren't sure that wasn't more explosive. Yeah. On the other hand, they all had the like Hurt Locker suits on.
Yes.
So I understand not wanting to like, you know, blow it up to lose evidence, but I don't know. I guess they figured the easiest way was to
do that. But like the whole like, the state engaging in corpse mutilation is like not a good look at all.
Well, and also they did it on site, which I also get that, but they'd cut him out of his clothing. So he's lying there. Like what they show us is more just sad. Than upset, like upsettingly gory, except for the one like Zapruder moment that we alluded to.
Right.
But he's like just in his tidy whiteies under a sheet, with his little skinny leg sticking out. And then they had to, they had to like set up a tent and just do it there to get the bomb off. And I mean, I see both sides of that. The whole thing was just what a sad end to this.
Yeah.
Innocent soul.
Total catastrophe. Sorry. Yeah. I can tell I feel comfortable on your show now that I just like, feel free to hijack the conversation.
It's
whatever.
Fine.
I so feel like it.
Just put your feet up. Do you want a glass for that beer? It's fine. That's true.
If you don't mind.
I don't. You know where they are. Okay, so that was really my fault because I doubled back to Evil Genius. Back to FBI files. The string of bank robberies committed by Hollywood and his occasional Reagan mask-wearing accomplice, speed shout-out, and increasingly ridiculous collection of wigs.
He looked like he was like in a Beastie Boys video.
He did. Thank you. I wasn't going to say anything unless you mentioned it, but he really did. He also, the reenactor in these bank robbery scenes is like, they never call this out, but he must be like doing what he thought Hollywood was doing, which was to give orders in a voice that he wouldn't usually use. So he sounds like he's imitating a chimp. I'm not sure it's in any of the clips that I pulled, but it was just making me laugh, which is probably not the intent.
The reenactments in general were so goofy.
Oh, and just
like they have that shootout where they're like standing like 20 feet away from each other and just blasting away. And like one guy he's behind like a car door and he just like steps out from around it with like a rifle and it's just blasting away. And these guys are blasting at him and he's just standing there. And then everybody jumps into their vehicles and takes off again.
Yeah.
I was like, what the hell is that all about?
Well, and then apparently he got away during that sequence, but all right, here's what the FBI was up against in clip 7.
In the 1990s, Seattle, Washington was plagued by hundreds of bank robberies. Most of the thieves were caught, but one continued to elude the FBI. Wearing a disguise, he stole millions, threatening to kill anyone who got in his way. With no leads and little evidence, agents feared the only way to stop him was to catch him in the act.
I was really stuck on the hundreds of bank robberies in the 1990s. I mean, I guess over the course of an entire decade. In a major metro area that has, you know, major league sports teams and whatnot. I guess that's not right. That many. But like, I watched part of this and then I had to go and meet up with my brother at his work. And I was just like laughing about like hundreds. Like, it's a good thing that we never lived in Seattle. And he reminded me, we used to live in the same house for a while, and he reminded me that there was a Santander bank in our neighborhood that was robbed twice in 3 weeks by the same guy.
Oh, really?
No mask, no wig. Just still at large, apparently. I looked it up.
So I – bank robbery just seems like – like in this day and age, and maybe things have gotten like I don't remember exactly what the deal was in the 90s with like trying to take money away from a bank. But it seems like now the amount of protections and stuff they have with that money, like GPS and exploding ink and this and that, it's like if you have the know-how to like figure out how to take care of all that stuff so you can get away with the money, you could probably figure out an easier way. You know, through computers or just like going after some place that's going to be like a better haul than a bank at this.
Yeah.
It just seems very like a dated enterprise.
Well, and it's funny that you should mention that you didn't know what the deal was with these security strategies, because I have a clip for that. You have been on this show a bunch of times. here's clip 8, where they talk about all the things that were in place to defeat Hollywood. And then I have a couple of questions as to why those measures failed.
Security strategies in Seattle banks at this time included using marked bills to trace stolen money. Another tactic was dye packs. Hidden inside a stack of bills, the packs contain red dye and an electronic charge. The pack detonates and stains a thief when he crosses sensors at the bank's exit. Silent alarms made it possible for tellers to call the police without alerting the robbers. Video cameras monitored every corner of the bank. So far, Hollywood had somehow managed to defeat all these measures.
Okay, first I'd like to note that the fake money that they're using in these flashbacks is fugazi. Like, it's not even green. Come on, guys. Second of all,
I didn't even know. I wasn't paying that close attention, I guess. I'm like a
currency nerd. So, like, when they get that kind of thing right, I think there are rules that the Treasury has about, like, how accurate your depiction of cash money on TV is allowed to be.
Uh-huh.
This was just, like, Monopoly money bad. That's one. Two, good intel on how dye packs work. I guess I just assumed that there was some kind of timed device, but that's because I've watched Raising Arizona like 58,000 times. So the sensors make sense. Thank you for explaining how that works. But then question 2B, why weren't they ever going off? Like, was
they did that one time, right?
Yeah, one time out of 18 attempts.
I mean, I do not put myself out as an expert on dye packs, but
get out.
If you got it buried in money in a sack, like that thing's really got to blow to get like ink on you, right? Like it's got to destroy all the money that's in the sack.
Yeah. Well, and I sort of thought the point was not to get the ink on the robber. The point really is so that he can't
spend
spoil
the money. Yeah. Right. Yeah, so I don't. Yeah,
so
that
maybe
whole thing,
he was ordering them to not to give him money that didn't have dye packs in it. But he was also like, if you call, like, if you trigger an alarm or call the police, I'm going to come back here and kill you.
Yeah, which is not a good strategy either.
Which apparently was an effective threat, but it's like, first of all, it's a silent alarm, and they weren't new. Like, you had those since the 70s, but he's not going to come back
right
and kill anybody.
I'm going to wait until the cops are here and then I'm going to start shooting.
I'm going to hide out nearby and make sure there's no law enforcement that I'm running from with stolen money. Well, I mean, look, I've never been at gunpoint, and I understand that you're not sort of like about to challenge somebody who's waving a pistol in your face, but just hit the silent alarm. Come on.
And then I didn't pick up on the whole I want bills without the dye pack, but
no, he did because it wasn't in there. They never said he did that.
Oh, I don't know.
Otherwise, 18 robberies, it would have
in terms of the problems with this show, I feel like this is fairly low on the.
Well, I think low. It's sort of I mean, the show is, this is a 50-minute episode. You can watch it on YouTube. We'll link it in the show notes. Should you care to bother. Like, I remember liking the show when it was originally on 15, 20 years ago on, I guess, Discovery Channel. But my standards have gone up. Like, I just, it just looked really cheap and also really seemed to be in the tank for the FBI and wasn't really willing to admit how basically bad they were at catching this dude, which, like, spoiler, they didn't exactly catch him. Like,
right.
They found him in a trailer, someone called them, and then he shot himself in the head.
I just, you know, I honestly, I thought this was really, really bad. Like, just boring. It was just, I mean, like, if you're going to summarize the whole thing, it was just like, there was this guy, and he dressed up in costume, so we called him Hollywood, and we couldn't catch him. And then we almost caught him one time, and we didn't. And then another time, we came pretty close to catching him. We had a shootout, and then they got away again. And then we caught him, and he wasn't there. But then then one of them said where he was, and then we found him, and he was dead. And that's the end of the story.
And like, there's multiple shootouts during which he escapes and like runs into some trees and gets away. And then also, this will also be in the show notes, this guy was a like local citizen of some repute for building this extremely elaborate treehouse. Like, pathways in the trees. I'm like, I'll watch a show about that. And I'm not totally uninterested in the FBI's take on like, how do you catch a guy who appears to be several steps ahead of us? Like the way that they eventually got him, like, okay, it didn't turn out to be correct, but they were close. But then there's whole scenes that they're just like, he might be a... Well, all right, I'll just play clip 9 because I bothered cutting it.
He noted the weapons he brandished were a 9mm Glock and a stun gun. At the time, these arms were being considered as weapons of choice among law enforcement. The detective also noticed that Hollywood indexed his trigger finger on the side of the 9mm, a technique taught to police officers. Many of the robberies occurred in the late morning, between 11 a.m. and noon, precisely the time when a shift change for the Seattle police occurred. The evidence pointed to a frightening possibility. Hollywood might be a cop.
Except he like spit it out. That was 47 seconds. He could have got that done in 17, drink some coffee. And he wasn't. And the fact that he wasn't is never followed up. Like, if you're going to go to those lengths to make us think that that's the twist and that's how they get him, and then it totally isn't.
Right.
At least mention it or be like, yeah, we never, like, unfortunately, he died by suicide, so we were never able to ascertain why he was,
right.
Like, whether that was purposefully throwing us off the scent. Like, I don't know. Interested in, but they always focus on these boring parts.
Yeah, maybe he was an evil genius and just realized that when the shift's changing, that might be a good time to rob something while some people are leaving and other people are coming.
Brinks truck has either already showed up or hasn't picked up the deposits yet. Like, he does this for a living, literally. Like, could be anything. Ask the bank.
I just – it kind of felt like somebody was – like, you ask a seventh grader to do a report on it. And it's just like, and then this happened, 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 and then this happened at the end. And there's like no, like, you really don't learn anything about that guy Hollywood.
No,
like you see his cool treehouse, and that's the extent of it. And then you find out he was an actor, and so there's no like psychological insight whatsoever that might have been somewhat interesting.
And there's really no suspense either. Like the way that they set up chases or like they've got a search warrant for his property. And like, could he be on one of those pathways in the trees? Like, they don't even say if he could be there. Just like one room at a time. We cleared the treehouse. Like, cool. Like, I've seen TV before. I could have figured that out. I don't know.
And there's one scene where I couldn't tell, because you see them, like, they're going into some structure, and I'm like, oh, did I just miss something? And then they pan out a little bit, and the woman who's their boss is, like, sitting at a desk in front of the structure. And I was like, are they training? Like, or is this the way they do it in Seattle? Is they bring a desk to the, like, crime scene and they just, like, set up on the street?
This, so I remember, because I made a note about the fact that it was extraneous. She was the FBI agent who was leading the task force to get this guy. But because he was not, like, crossing state lines or taking any hostages, strictly speaking, it was a matter for local law enforcement. So the FBI people in the task force had to train local law enforcement in the event of, like, if they were present the next time he was at a bank and they trapped him in there and he did take hostages, like, how you deal with this. Like, you could have just told us that that was necessary and not taken
this confounding scene.
Yeah. I mean, I took the opportunity to, like, just go pee while that was happening, because I was like, well, it's the FBI files and this is going to go on for a while. You know what else I didn't really need to know about is that agent's Thanksgiving rescheduling.
Yes.
Like, this is the life we have chosen, clip 10.
Right.
By that point in time, I had decided not to cook a turkey on Thanksgiving. I had changed the reservations for where we were going to eat Thanksgiving to a later time so that we could all be together as a family. And we were almost out the door when we got a call from the office that Hollywood was barricaded in a trailer.
Cool story.
Yeah. A last little fuck you from Hollywood. I'm going to ruin your Thanksgiving dinner.
I kind of wanted him to have pinned a note to himself that was like, did you learn nothing from D.B. Cooper, suckers?
So here's my question is,
why did I make you watch this? I said I was sorry.
Yeah, that's the overall arching question. But am I right in that they got caught robbing a bank, and then there was a shootout, and then he escaped, and then they tracked it, then they questioned the person, they tracked him down. That must have taken several days.
I think, because the robbery was on the Thanksgiving Eve, and then this chase, which was like a four-stage chase where occasionally everyone would just pull over and shoot at each other at point-blank range for a while. And then at one of these stops, and then eventually he'd get sick of it and be like, all right, boys, let's go. And then they'd, like, get back in the Scooby van and drive off. And it was like Police Squad. It was so bad. But is the show going to admit that the FBI really bungled this? No. So I think at some point at night, if the reenactments were to be believed, in the confusion while everybody was hiding behind their car doors and shooting at each other, Hollywood, like, disappeared into some nearby underbrush and I think hid out in a trailer that wasn't even his or anyone's that he knew. That was also confusing. Like, how can there be all this extraneous information that's relayed so slowly, but we're still confused as to what happened?
Right. So that reminded me of, you know, the Boston Marathon guy who hid out in that boat.
Yes.
It's sort of a similar thing. I think they just found some place where they could find shelter and hide, but without, like, what the next step's going to be.
I wonder if there's a book written about this that's any good, because I will say this, like, you know, I consume a lot of true crime as my job and that's fine. But, like, the vast majority of, like, the cases that you're interfacing with when you do what you and I do is murders. So a bank robbery, like a series of bank robberies, art forgery, I'm fascinated by those things. And also it's like a nice break from the nonstop bloodletting. Like, not that there isn't bloodletting in a bank robbery sometimes, but I had really had much higher hopes for this. And it is like a middle school book report. You're totally right.
The only thing that we haven't addressed, which was in some ways my favorite part, is when he goes to confer with the electronics expert, who's nicknamed The Glitch. Yeah. And then when they show him, he's just like this like stereotypical nerd. It looks like he came from Revenge of the Nerds.
I know, he really does. Like, total nerd central casting. It's amazing.
The Glitch.
Just, The Glitch.
It's like, what is it with these nicknames? Hollywood and The Glitch.
Oh, my God.
Anyway, it's just in keeping with a shitty show.
Well, that's another, like, in the like in Evil Genius, where it's like, I would like to watch, like, whatever. It's not a spinoff. It's a docuseries, but I would still like to know more about Marjorie Deal Armstrong's former Selly.
Yeah.
The Glitch. Like, all right, give that guy his own show. I mean,
that would be awesome. The Glitch.
Yeah.
Starring Andy Dick or something. Or,
yeah, like The Glitch Files, and it would just be like flashback, or like give him his whole give him a whole season to himself on Drunk History or something like that. I'd watch it. This I can't recommend. Like, I said, I feel like I enjoyed FBI Files, like, you know, on a hungover Sunday, rainy Sunday, just like to, you know, be soothed by tales of the feds. But this is like, it's unenjoyable physically to watch either. It's like overexposed and cheap looking. So yeah, can't recommend.
Yeah, it's horrendous. In some ways, like, I think, like, maybe some of the other episodes were good, but this episode would have sucked in any decade. But I think, you know, the genre has, like, improved. Like, even though there's a lot of shitty stuff still out there, like, putting that, it's really not fair having that and Evil Genius in the same show.
Well, yeah.
Because it's just like, it's like cave paintings versus like some real piece of art, you know. I'm not trying to say that Evil Genius is a work of art, but it just is so further evolved,
yeah,
in all aspects than that FBI thing, that it doesn't show it in a very good light.
There was an interview I did, actually, I referred to this before we started recording, with Eric Deggans, who is the TV critic and critic at large, I believe, now for NPR. And we were talking about how, like, TV episodes used to be like 50 minutes long, like this one was, instead of a trim 41 or 42. And he's like, if you watch these old episodes of like Hill Street Blues, Knight Rider, like, what, the extra 8 minutes is all like people driving up to buildings or walking towards things, or like establishing shots that go on it, that you're like, okay, we get it. Like a quick shot of the hospital. Hello. Nothing, right. Like, we haven't, not that more commercials are good, but the stuff that they cut from the show, you never miss it. And this, right, is like a key example that, like, this same show made today would still be garbage, but it would be done sooner. Like, if it's on your DVR, right, you're done in 40 minutes instead of, yeah, 50.
You can get on with your life.
Exactly. So let's do that. Let's get on with our lives. Speaking of your life, Toby, where can listeners be on the lookout for other things that you do?
I am, every week I'm on Crime Writers On podcast. And you can find me on Twitter at TobyBallNH. And there's now a Patreon book club at the Partners in Crime Patreon page. And I guess that's about it.
Yeah, you're up to two episodes now?
Two episodes, yep. We did, the first one was on I'll Be Gone in the Dark, which was about the Golden State Killer, which is recently in the news because they found him. And then this month, as you well know, because you were on it, we did Killers of the Flower Moon by David Gran.
Yeah, definitely give that a listen if you've read the book. I'm definitely interested to hear what other people thought about it. And that's our episode. Got a tip for the Blotter Presents Case Files? Visit our forums at previously.tv or hit me on social media. That's at Blotter Presents on both Facebook and Twitter. My guest, once again, has been Toby Ball. He's getting a beer, but you can find him on Twitter at TobyBallNH. I'm Sarah D. Bunting, and I'm on Twitter at Tomato Nation. We'll talk to you next time.
This has been a production of the Previously.tv Podcast Network.